providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to shift our focus for these last two segments over to the energy sector, as we are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, Dan, we usually go and start off at more of the data that we have seen recapping, let's say, last month or the last couple months. But you recently sent us a presentation that you made, and you wanted to focus on one slide in that presentation. Now, if everybody or if anybody wants this presentation, all you have to do is email us. We will put you in touch with Dan. But it was slide 7 that you were highlighting that looks at the projected growth in energy demand in the coming decades. So this goes the whole way out to 2050. Now, obviously, these projections, boy, oh boy, things can change in a matter of just under 30 years. But these projections were saying that oil projected to grow about 1%, natural gas demand projected to grow about 0.9%, and renewables also projected to grow about 3.3%. So overall, still growth in every category. Renewals, yeah, leading the way, but right now you go back to current, renewals are much less in terms of demand from natural gas and oil, and it's projected to grow to pretty much the same as oil, if not more. Dan, how do you take these longer-term growth outlooks into an investment narrative? What do you discount? What do you put more value in?
Well, the total demand for energy, that's all forms of energy, it correlates with population growth. And what they're saying is between now and 2050, the population of the world is going to go up another 2 billion people. So we just crossed 8 billion. I could believe I'm 68 years old, and when I was born, the world's population was 2.5 billion and now it's 8 billion. So just in my lifetime, the world's population has tripled. And so another 2 billion, which is going to put us over 10 billion people on planet Earth, unless the middle class is willing to accept a much lower standard of living in the future, much smaller homes, just consuming a lot less of all forms of energy, overall demand for energy. And even if everybody's 50% of the people are driving electric cars, you still got to produce that electricity from burning something. That electricity is going to come from coal plants, natural gas plants. And, you know, nobody even ever talks about nuclear. Yeah. And on that chart I showed you, it's barely growing over that 30, 40 year period. So we're stuck with oil, gas, and coal is going to produce like 80% of all energy, even electricity. And the only thing that I see is really wind and solar. Yes, it's keeping a lid on natural gas demand a little bit, but it's pretty much targeting coal-fired power plants because wind and solar produce electricity. They don't produce transportation fuels other than, you know, if, you know, everybody goes to EVs, but I really don't see that happening. Everybody that I talk to on the EV side, they really shake their head at these forecasts that, you know, 50% of the people are going to be driving EVs pretty soon because we just don't have the materials. Talk to copper companies, lithium companies and stuff, and they just say there just isn't enough of these materials in the world to meet that level of demand.
Yeah, that is so true, Dan. There's just policies and then there's reality, and there's not nearly enough charging stations, not nearly enough copper, not nearly enough battery materials to make it all happen at the rate that they expect it to. But the other thing that you brought up there, which is key, is that the power generation has to come from somewhere, and it's not going to all come from renewables. It's going to be coming from nat gas plants. Even though we've seen a pullback in the energy sector, oil and nat gas in general, you have a lot of information that you put out to your subscribers about the inventory builds, the strategic reserves, where we're at. Could you break down just where things are at, the climate right now with oil and nat gas, as far as where are we at with supply and demand?
Well, crude oil inventories, commercial crude oil inventories are slightly above where they usually are on the five-year average. Of course, we use more of it than we did five-year average, but also our gasoline inventories are 7% below the five-year average right now, and our distillate, which is diesel and home heating oil, is 17% below the five-year average. And we're just now getting some serious cold weather into the Northeast. and the Northeast, the New York, New England states, they still burn a lot of oil for space heating. And they really have had a very mild winter up until this point. So I think in the next couple of weeks, they're going to be really drawing down those heating oil inventories. And also, they have been importing a lot of refined diesel and heating oil from Europe and from Russia. And that's getting harder to do. And it's because they don't have enough pipelines. They won't approve any pipelines coming into that region. And so they're cut off. So if you live in New England, you know, you're paying much higher fuel prices than we pay down here in Texas.
Dan, how does this tie into another slide you have in your presentation that was outlining that because of the investment that the U.S. made on growing its oil and gas production, it attained energy independence and is the world's largest producer of oil and gas? But that still doesn't sound like it's enough to actually satisfy some of these shocks.
Yeah, right. We still import a lot of products and we export a lot. See, we have excess refining capacity in the United States. And so South America depends heavily on a steady supply of diesel, propane, gasoline, probably down in, like in the Caribbean. The Caribbean countries don't have a lot of refineries or anything. So I mean, if we take a cruise out of Galveston down here, we're constantly passing tanker ships going back and forth. So, you know, the Gulf Coast region down here exports a lot. So, you know, it's just like, you know, could we produce all the food we need in the United States? Yes, but we still import other kind of foods and we export a lot of food. So it's an interdependence that we have on energy with other countries, but we are no longer energy independent. I guess if we had to, we could be, but that would mean we'd have to burn a lot more coal for power generation, and we'd have to move very quickly to running a lot more vehicles on compressed natural gas. And frankly, you know, I actually think that's one of the biggest areas that is neglected. I went to a presentation several years ago when we have an abundance of natural gas. North America has like the largest natural gas reserves in the world. And so we have very cheap, very abundant natural gas. If we would convert half of our 18-wheelers, the large trucks, to run on compressed natural gas, you could drastically lower our demand for oil-based fuels, and gas burns cleaner. The problem is you don't have compressed natural gas filling stations along the highways. You would have to build out a lot of infrastructure to make that happen, which is the same thing with EVs also. We need a lot more infrastructure, charging stations and stuff, if we're going to have a high percentage of EVs on the road.
Well, Dan, you know, you brought up nat gas there and how we do have an abundance of it in the United States, but it's a little different in that it's kind of a regional market. And it's really been getting the news lately because if you think about last year, nat gas got up over $9, almost pushing 10, and now it's down around 250 today in U.S. pricing. But break down the natural gas markets for us in the U.S., but then also abroad. What's the setup right now in nat gas?
Well, in the U.S., I can tell you, 6 weeks ago, I was super bullish on natural gas. I thought we were looking at $8 to $10 natural gas this winter in the U.S., and now here we're back at like $2.50. And what happened was we had Winter Storm Elliott, which was the last 2 weeks of December. Those were two of the biggest draws ever in December. And then immediately, we have a build in January, the first week of January. We have the mildest January weather in the eastern half of the United States probably ever, and it caused a build. And also, we've increased our natural gas production in the United States by about 4 or 5 BCF a day. But the big thing that's caused this little surplus that we have right now, and it really isn't, you know, this is 100 BCF a day gas market when you include exports. So, you know, if we get to the end of March and storage is 300 or 400 BCF above, that's like, you know, 4 or 5 days supply. It's not that big of a deal. So we are stuck with some low natural gas prices until we get to the end of winter. Winter's not done yet. We're just at the beginning of February. So we still got a long way to go in winter. We know down here in Texas, the worst winter storm we ever had was the second week of February. So when we had about a 330 BCF draw from storage. So it can correct itself. But the other thing that's going to correct it is, and I follow a lot of natural gas producers, with gas prices lower, and what they'll do is they will adjust their drilling programs. They will slow down their drilling programs. They're all committed to live within cash flow. And all the really big gas producers like Antero Resources, EQT, Range Resources, Most of their acreage is already held by production, so they do not have a bunch of drilling obligations just to keep acreage. The pipeline capacity coming out of the Permian for natural gas is pretty much full, so there's not a lot of upside there. Actually, the pipelines out of the Appalachia, that's Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, those are full. You know, you've heard the stuff about Joe Manchin wanting to get his pipeline through West Virginia approved, and they keep blocking that. So we're kind of peaked out on natural gas production growth now, but we will be stuck with some low gas prices here. At least the only thing that could bring it back, let's say we have a colder than normal March and winter goes into April, so that shortens the refill season. That could impact it. We have an active hurricane season that shuts down some production in the Gulf of Mexico. That'll have some impact. But also, when natural gas prices get this low, what'll happen, the electric power companies, a lot of them have the ability to switch from coal to natural gas. So if natural gas stays really cheap and it actually burns cleaner, reducing their carbon emissions, when push comes to shove, if everything's equal, they would rather produce electricity with natural gas than coal anyway. So, you know, the power burn will pick up and it'll rebalance itself. But then once you get past this year, 2023, there are a lot more LNG export facilities coming online. We're going to go from a 14 BCF a day full capacity, LNG export capacity of when Freeport gets back online, we're going to go to 23 or 24 BCF export capacity by 2027. So the U.S. gas market is going to be very tight. And I think by the time we get there, we're going to see natural gas prices much, much higher. A new threshold, maybe in the $6, $7, $8 range, but that's still really cheap on an energy basis compared to the BTU content of oil.
So how are you viewing the natural gas companies as an investment right now? Even though they can pull back on their drilling and their spend, they're not generating that kind of cash flow right now. So is it more a waiting game for them? Make sure that the company can at least survive into a period where it just seems a bit more longer term bullish for the natural gas price.
And you got to remember, they survived, you know, 12 years of gas averaging like 250. The thing about natural gas wells, they're much cheaper to operate. That most of them are flowing wells. So you just have a wellhead. You don't have pump jacks or anything. And the gas market will adjust, but they can easily survive 250. Most of the companies that I follow, the upstream gas companies, their total cash cost are about $1 an MCF. So even at 250, they have gross profit of $1.50. Now, the other thing is, and you know, even though you saw those big high prices in the futures market, none of them really got those prices. They had hedged forward or they had long-term supply contracts that locked in, you know, lower prices anyway. So very few of the companies got more than $5 for their gas anyway. And they used that. It was a great year. Some of them had record cash flows. And they paid down a lot of debt. They want to get away from all the bank debt that pressure puts on them. And a lot of these companies are buying back their shares. They pay great dividends and they want to keep paying the dividends. And I think the ones that have dividends and stock buybacks, the first thing they'll cut back on is the stock buybacks. Because they would like to, you know, keep their dividends pretty high. But we have a high yield income portfolio. And in that, the average dividend yield is 8%. And some of even the highest dividend paying one in there is Blackstone Minerals, and its dividend is like 11%. And they do have about 50% of their gas hedged at pretty good prices.
Well, that was a question we'd received from some people, Dan, so I'm glad you addressed it about the hedging and how safe are the dividends. But another area that you focus on is growth, and you've got a small cap growth group. You've got your Sweet 16 group. So when people look into growth, there are companies that are just pure gassers. There's some that are just oily names, but most companies are hybrids. They've got some oil, they've got some liquids, they've got some natural gas. Which ones do you think have the best platform for growth moving forward?
Yeah, I personally like a very balanced portfolio when it comes to different products. You want not equal amounts. You're not going to get that. But right now you want to be more in oil than gas, but oil and then natural gas liquids, which is your propane, butane, and all that, those prices are higher on a MCFE basis than natural gas also. Yeah, I like the more balanced ones. And some of them, you know, they continually hedge like half of their production. So they're pretty predictable. But again, they've paid off so much debt. These companies are in great shape. And like our Sweet 16, it trades at less than 3x cash flow, even to these lower commodity prices that they still trade. And remember, I mean, they survived a long period of $40 oil. You know, 2020 oil dropped to like $12, and it took till the end of the year till it got back up to 40 or 50 and averaged about 50 through 2021. So they can handle much lower prices than this. And even if I put $70 in these models for oil, they're all generating free cash flow. All of our Sweet 16 are free cash flow positive.
Now, what about the balance between the larger cap compared to the smaller cap companies, understanding that the smaller cap companies, some were a fraction, a tenth of the price that they were just a couple years ago. Do you still see value in some of those small caps that have run up so much? Or do you like some of the bigger guys that, who knows, could get more into that M&A game?
Yeah. And I tell you, I am very bullish on the price of oil. I think by the end of this year, we're going to be at triple digits again. The oil market is seasonal, and the first quarter is the lowest period of the year for energy demand. And as long as China's economy comes back online, we will have a situation where supply growth cannot keep up with demand growth. And that will happen probably within 6 months. And I get price targets from Goldman Sachs, from Morgan Stanley, from Raymond James, and they are all predicting triple digit oil prices by the end of this year because OECD inventories have been drawn down. And like we talked earlier, our commercial oil inventory, the crude oil inventory is kind of above normal, but refined product inventories are way below normal. And that's true for the OECD countries as well. As for all of Europe, their refined product inventories are too low. And so you have to start rationing by price. I mean, that's what happens. And you've got to get these guys to produce in more oil. And that's not going to happen unless you have high prices. So I see that. But yeah, I like growth. And the biggest gains we've ever had have come from finding small caps that have a lot of running room. And I call that they have a lot of low risk, high yield drilling inventory that they can, drill these wells. They pay out in 6 to 9 months, these oil wells now at today's prices, and they can build and up a, strong production growth, strong proven reserves. And the thing that happens in this business, it's a commodity-based business. And if the value of your underlying assets exceeds your stock price by a lot, either the stock price has to go up or they're going to be taken over. And you're going to see a lot more M&A activity. That what we're seeing down here in the States is the public companies are buying up some of these private companies. We saw that Matador Resources announced a big acquisition is going to increase their production and their running room by like 25-30%, pushing them up to like 130,000 barrels a day of production. And I remember when that company, 5-6 years ago was under 10,000 barrels a day of production. So you see that in-play oil up there in Canada just a couple years ago was 2,500 barrels a day. And now it's like 10,000 barrels a day of production. And that was done through acquisitions and a very successful drilling program. So that's what we're really looking for. And I would say in our group, I get more questions about the small caps than I do the large. I mean, the large caps, they have so much, Wall Street coverage anyway. You're not really uncovering anything. Small caps have more risk just because they are commodity price takers. And, if they have a dry hole or something, bad happens, it's more impactful than the companies that have, thousands and thousands of wells online.
Well, Dan, just one more thing I think it'd be nice to highlight is what I like about your service is when you're looking at the small cap growth or the Sweet 16, you have kind of the energy prospectus group fair value estimate, and then you show people how undervalued you think each stock is. How do you come up with a rough idea of how you come up with those valuations, and why do you think there is still so much room for these things to run, even considering how much they already did run last year?
Yeah, I value all the companies on a cash flow basis. For one thing, the oil and gas accounting rules are so misleading, the SEC accounting rules, that reported net income is almost a meaningless number. So focus on operating cash flow. So if a company is generating enough operating cash flow to fund 100% of their drilling and completion activity so they can grow their production and proven reserves by themselves. They don't need to tap into the equity market. They don't need to get bank loans. They can fund it all themselves. So that's step one of a company I want to own. Step two is, do they have a strong balance sheet and look at their debt, make sure they don't have, you know, any big senior debt coming maturing in the next year or so that they're going to be unable to pay off. So do they have access to that kind of capital? And running room. I mean, running room is a really big deal. What kind of acreage do they have? Again, I'll tell you, on InPlay, he has got hundreds of drilling locations now that are very economical and oil focused. He's going to focus more on increasing his oil production this year than last year. And, you know, once a company gets to 10,000 barrels a day, you can do the math. You do $70 times 10,000 a day, and you're talking real money there on a monthly basis. They can fund a lot of growth. So that's what I'm after. And it's, I think growth or aggressive growth companies got confused with, you know, high risk, outspending your cash flow. And the one thing, because seismic's gotten so much better, horizontal drilling technology's gotten so much better, you hardly ever hear these companies report a dry hole. Like when I was working at Hess, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we were happy if one out of every three or four wells was good well. You know, we drilled a lot of dry holes. But now the seismic is just so good. They've defined the reservoir so well, you hardly ever get any bad wells.
All right, Dan, we'll wrap it up here. I like how essentially you're just trying to simplify it, right? Look at cash flows. Look at the financials. And that is the beauty of the sector, is that, look, these guys get to cash flow very quickly. Sometimes that cash flow can dissipate. Sometimes it can also explode higher. Well, we saw the explosion higher last year. This year, who knows? Even if we're in a flat energy environment for oil, well, natural gas needs a little bit of an improvement. These companies are still doing quite well. Dan, it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Again, if you guys have any questions for Dan, want us to put you in touch with him, please email us directly. The Energy Prospectus Group is a wealth of information for the active investor in the energy space. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through the week. Check out all the company updates, all the other interviews we have recorded, and you can always reach out to Shad and I if you have any questions or want us to touch base with any companies. Dan, thanks again for your time on this weekend show. Everybody else, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.